You're listening to The Sweeper, the pan-European football podcast that brings you all the news from the 55 UEFA nations and sometimes a little bit beyond.
On this episode, we talk about the qualifying rounds for the European club competitions, discuss the island games in Guernsey, and round up all the headlines from the summer leagues. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Sweeper, hosted by myself, Lee Wingate, and Paul Watson, who is about to embark upon a long journey to the other side of the world to watch Micronesia's first ever futsal tournament. In fact, by the time this podcast hits the airwaves, he'll likely be there on the ground. Paul will obviously dedicate a large chunk of the next episode to hear all about it, but for now, perhaps just give us a travel overview. How long is it going to take, and can you break down the different steps of this mammoth journey for us?
It's going to take a very long time. So I leave here, the UK, I leave Wednesday very early in the morning. I arrive in Micronesia when it is Friday, middle of the day. And it's going to be going to initially Paris, which is the curveball. So Korean Airlines have decided in their wisdom to not just fly me straight to Seoul, but to cancel that flight and make me go to Paris and then on to Seoul. So that makes this flight look even more ridiculous, that I fly just 1 hour to Paris, then on to Seoul, Seoul to Guam, and then Guam on to Pompeii, but you stop for about an hour in Chuuk, which is one of the Micronesian islands competing, which is next door to Pompeii.
You mentioned on your recent appearance on the Guardian Football Weekly that the last time you visited Micronesia in 2014, the plane overflew and landed on the wrong island. Do you think there's any danger of that happening this time?
I really hope not. It depends on how the weather is. These runways are really, really short. And I remember when I first flew to Micronesia, I was really like unnerved by just how you come in and you look like you're over ocean and you just hit. You just bump and then you realize you're on land because the runways are so incredibly short. And then, yeah, sure enough, one time the weather was so bad that the plane just carried on flying and I hadn't realized and just woke up and was in the wrong island. It's just kind of like missing your stop on the bus. But I genuinely thought that's what had happened, that I'd like missed my stop. So I absolutely panicked. I said, you know, what's going on? And they just said, oh, we overflew. What do you mean you're overflow? And all it just means is, yeah, if the weather's too bad, they just fly to the next island and then they try and fly you back when they can. So I'm really hoping that doesn't happen, because if I end up in Koh Rai while the tournament's taking place in Pompeii, that would be unfortunate.
To break down this journey into numbers for the listeners, so it's 60 hours by plane, four different flights, as you explained there, 13,228 kilometres, and it's across 10 time zones. So for your sake, I really, really hope that you don't overfly and land on the wrong island.
Yeah, me too. God, when you say it sounds terrible.
We will, as I say, talk a lot more about that on the next episode in the first segment. Perhaps we'll even have two segments, depending on how much you've got to share. But on to today's episode now, and we're going to be focusing on the best part of the European club calendar in part one, the qualifying rounds for the continental competitions, which will see 54 UEFA countries, that's all of them except suspended Russia, battle it out for a place in the Champions League, Europa League or Conference League. It's already got underway, hasn't it, with the preliminary qualifying round in Iceland. We touched on this on the Patreon episode. Perhaps you can tell the listeners a little bit about this four-team mini tournament.
Yeah, sure. So this is the way the format is for the real minnows, is they have four teams who go to one location. This time it was Iceland, and they play a sort of small tournament, semis and a final, and the winner of that was drawn through to play against Shamrock Rovers. So it's quite a brutal short format. It means that for some of these teams, their Champions League dream lasts literally 90 minutes. It's not a two-legged affair. You just get one match. And I have to say, this year was a bad advert for the preliminary rounds. There was a feeling going into it that perhaps the Icelandic side, Breiðablik, were going to be too strong, that they were going to be outmatched these other teams. And that was very much how it proved. So in the opening game, Budućnost Podgorica beat the Andorran side, Athletic Club Del Skalda, 3-0. Very routine victory. So Athletic Club de Escaldes became the dubious honour of the first club eliminated from the Champions League, I think, you know, only a matter of days after the final of the last one. And then the next game was San Marino's Trapani, who were destroyed by Predablik, the home team, 7-1. Now, the only one glimmer of light there was that Trapani were scoring their first goal in the competition in a decade. They actually last scored when they became the first San Marinese side to win a game in European competition, when they beat Armenian side Chirac 1-0. That was 10 years ago. Sounds great, but they had already lost the first leg 3-0. So those two games took place, which set up this final between Budućnost Podgorica and Predablik, the hosts from Iceland. And that was a very one-sided affair. It was 5-0 to Predablik, the Icelandic side. So very much what everyone expected to happen did happen, but it happened a bit more emphatically than I think most people, myself included, expected.
I saw that right after this tournament, Breiðablik striker Stefan Ingi Sigurdarson, who's the top scorer in the Icelandic league this season so far, is moving to the Belgian second division. So I think that shows you the sort of imbalance between some of these countries, that somebody is leaving a club that's still in the Champions League qualifying rounds for the second tier in Belgium. And talking of the second tier, one of our favourite things to keep an eye on in Europe are the lower league participants, clubs from outside the top tier that make it into the qualifying rounds, usually by virtue of winning their domestic cup. Sadly, there's only one this season, and it's not an overly surprising name. Any guesses?
Ooh, that's a very good question. You caught me on the hop there. It's not a surprising name, and yet they're a second division team who are playing in the Champions League.
Not in the Champions League.
Oh, in the European qualifying rounds. Oh, it should be really obvious, shouldn't it? So is it someone who was relegated but won the cup or something?
No, it's a country that I've been to very recently, and they are the cup winners.
Oh, of course, it's Vaduz, isn't it? It's FC Vaduz. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that always throws me. So they are still second tier in Switzerland and competing for Liechtenstein. Yeah, of course. And actually had a brilliant campaign last season, so it will be interesting to see how they fare.
I was at the game in Vienna when they beat Rapid Vienna to qualify for the group stages, and that was really quite something. I'm a little bit gutted that the fourth tier reserves of Lokomotiv Tbilisi didn't win the Georgian Cup, which would have seen them participate in the Conference League qualifiers.
Is that, would they have been allowed? Are there any rules about reserve teams competing in a Champions League? I mean, maybe they've never had to make a rule, but it sounds like something that they would have a spoil sport rule that would prevent happening to me.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that the first team would have taken their place in the Conference League qualifiers. It's almost certain, but I just love the idea of a fourth tier reserve team taking part. As it is, Vaduz are the only team from outside the top tier, and they'll be up against Belarusian team Neman Grodno, who are only in the competition due to a ban imposed on Islok Minsk Rayon for a match-fixing incident which dates back to 2016. And that brings us on to the excluded clubs, which won't be taking part in European competition this season, even though they would have been expected to. We've got three clubs that have been banned by UEFA. Islok Minsk Rayon are one of them. There are two others. One of them are from one of your very favourite countries.
Not from Micronesia. Not from San Marino, are they?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes, they are. I read about this. Is it Virtus?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So were they banned? What were they banned for match fixing then?
This was, I think it was an illegal betting scandal back in 2017. So they are the San Marinese Cup winners, and they would have been making their debut in European competition this season. So that one's especially harsh. And then you've got Osasuna as well. Now, this is quite unusual that you get a club from one of Europe's bigger leagues, but they've also been banned for a match-fixing incident that took place a decade ago. Actually, it was in the 2012-13 and 13-14 seasons. So those are the three that are banned by UEFA.
I have to say, it seems a little bit harsh or odd to ban people for an incident that took place nearly a decade ago. Mm-hmm. It feels like the wheels of justice have moved so slowly, it seems the people currently involved might be completely uninvolved in those incidents.
Yeah, you certainly do get the impression that UEFA are coming down a lot harder on match-fixing incidents at the moment, because, as I say, all three of those bans are for the same thing. You've also got Pristina. They didn't get a UEFA license. Beitar Jerusalem were suspended for their behaviour at the Israeli Cup final, which we talked about on a Patreon episode. That ban has been overturned, so they're now taking part. And then, of course, you've got the Belarusian clubs, Shakhtar Soligorsk and Energetic BGU, that lost their places to other Belarusian clubs due to match fixing. But the case of Virtus, who would have been making their European debut, let's talk a little bit about the European debutants right now, because we've got 10. This stat comes courtesy of DB Absur on Twitter. You've got Brighton from England, Adana Demirspor from Turkey, CSKA 1948 from Bulgaria, Sabah from Azerbaijan, Alda from Latvia, Higelman, Lithuania, Dukagini from Kosovo, Ignatia from Albania, Penny Bont from Wales, and Arsenal Tivat from Montenegro. That's quite a few debutants. Are there any that stand out there that you're particularly looking forward to seeing?
There's a few that catch the eye. So one of the ties that was a real mouth-watering one for me is Penny Bont are playing against FC Santa Coloma from Andorra. I just always love watching the Andorran sides. I love the minnows. But Penny Bont against Santa Coloma just sounds like a really romantic kind of tie, I think. For their first ever European tie, it's going to be really interesting. Santa Coloma actually are only third in Andorra at the moment. You would think actually the Welsh side might have the better of them. Another one that jumped out at me was we mentioned this team, Arsenal Tivat from Montenegro. We mentioned them before in that their rise has been relatively rapid in recent times, in that they only had their first season in the top flight in 2022-23. That was their first top flight season in the current format of the league. I remember, find it quite funny, they have one foreign player and he's called Julian Montenegro. And the other thing that I did find out, and I don't know much about this, but it's quite interesting to me, is that Adana Demirspor, who are coached by Patrick Kluivert at the moment, a very familiar name, are a railway club. And that's what the club's name and what their sort of identity is. I didn't really realise this, that Demirspor clubs are clubs, football clubs that were founded by employees of Turkish railways.
Yeah.
Which actually is also true of the locomotive clubs in Eastern Europe. I'd never even put two and two together. It sounds really silly, but growing up, I never thought locomotive. I wonder why club would be called that. So what it means is that, yeah, they are a railway club and that there were 38 railway clubs in Turkey. But I think I'm right in saying that Adana Demirspor are the only ones that are still actually affiliated with Turkish railways, Turkish state railways.
That's a great fact. I would never have known that. Okay, so we'll watch out for Adana Demirspor and see if they slide off the rails at anytime soon.
That's happened, didn't it? What's your pick, Lee? Who are your debutants to watch?
I would have also said Arsenal Tivat, but also CSKA 1948 is one that I am particularly looking forward to because they are playing FCSB. So one of the CSKA successors are playing one of the Steaua Bucharest successors in, I think, the second qualifying round of the Conference League. So that won't be for a few weeks. That's probably the standout one. But there are another couple of ties that I looked at from a geographical perspective, as I usually tend to. So I've worked out the biggest away day that is taking place based on the fixtures we already have available.
I'd expect nothing less of you. You know, as soon as these ties came out, I was like, I bet someone's got Google Maps on right now.
Yeah, I went through them all this morning. Lincoln Red Imps and Karabag is the fixture that is the biggest away day. 4,763.81 kilometers between them.
That is a serious trip, isn't it? And obviously they're both going to have to visit each other. That's a really long one.
Oof. It is a lot, but they've got nothing on you.
No, but for them to be in the same continent, that's the thing, isn't it? It's kind of an amazing thought that this is like a continental away day. And also interesting that they don't regionalize, which they do obviously in other competitions. People regionalize in order to keep the long away days away from the early rounds. And I'm in favor of them not, because it's brilliant, but it's quite interesting that they don't do that and that these ties can be so unwieldy.
Yeah, the good thing I think for Lincoln Red Imps is that they won't be too fazed by this mammoth journey, because last season in the Conference League, they went to Kostanai, Kazakhstan, which is 800 kilometers further. So perhaps they're well-traveled by now. They're used to it. The shortest away day I could find was Zola Egerzeg of Hungary versus Osijek of Croatia. That's only 200 kilometers apart. So I guess that's the European equivalent of a local derby. I just wanted to throw in a story from a wedding that I went to in Belgrade a couple of weeks ago, which might seem like a massive tangent to go off on. But I went to a wedding. It was quite a lavish one, I have to say. So it had a brass band there that simply did not stop until the father of the groom gave them enough money. That's sort of the tradition. So they just went on forever. They also had a singer who I can only describe as like the Balkan equivalent of Tina Turner. She's called Lepa Brena, and she's super famous. I didn't necessarily think much of her music myself, but she was there. But for me, the highlight was bumping into one of the other guests there, who was none other than the general director of Borac Banja Luka, the Bosnian club, who are going to be in the Conference League qualifying rounds this season. And they are playing against Austria Vienna. That means that Borac Banja Luka will be coming to the town where I live. So I got his number, and I'm going to be meeting the general director of Borac Banja Luka for a coffee at the end of the month when he's in Vienna. So that was sort of my random story from my travels this summer.
That is random. God, you hang in different circles to me. that's like a much more opulent sort of wedding than one I've ever been to.
I certainly felt very out of place there. It was definitely an unusual affair for me, but it was great just to meet somebody in the football world and have a nice chat to him. Very down to earth, and I'll be sort of crossing my fingers for Borac Banja Luka because he seemed like a really nice guy, but also wanting the Vienna clubs to do well. So caught between a rock and a hard place with that one. We'll draw a line under our mammoth UEFA club competition qualifying preview there. After a little bit of music, we'll be back to talk about a European competition of a very different kind. Welcome back to part two of the Sweeper podcast, a segment that I'm particularly looking forward to because I know next to nothing about the topic we're talking about, and that is the Ireland Games. So this is a little venture into the world of football that is not recognised by UEFA or FIFA, and Paul, as our resident expert on all such matters, is going to tell us a little bit more about the Ireland Games and who takes part.
Yeah, so I would have been at the Ireland Games. I've always wanted to go. I would have been there. It's in Guernsey this summer, but it happens to clash with my trip to Micronesia, so quite inconvenient, really. There's an organisation called the International Ireland Games Association, and you have to be, to qualify, you have to be an island territory, but you have to have a population of under 125,000. It's a very specific number. You have to also be able to compete in two different sports. So the Ireland Games is almost like an Olympics in terms of there are lots of different events, and people from islands in the association can come and send their delegations. Football is just one of the sports on show. Now, what's interesting, I think, is to qualify, if you think about under 125,000 and an island, you would actually have lots of people who would qualify for that globally. But there's a caveat that it has to only have at most 25 members. Currently, the Ireland Games Association actually has 24, so there's room for one more, I believe. But it seems like it's a very hard thing to break into. So there are these islands who have been in it for years, and the names keep coming up year after year. And for them, it's like a massive opportunity because, I guess, for a lot of these football teams specifically, it creates an opportunity for competition that just does not exist for other outlets. And I'm thinking specifically of, for example, St Helena. So St Helena, one of the very tiny British dependency, one of the most remote islands in the world. If you don't know where it is, you're probably like most people in the world. It's a tiny dot somewhere between Europe and South America, effectively. It's Tristan da Cunha is widely known to be like the most remote inhabited island, I think, in the world. It's in that same region next to Ascension Island and relatively near the Falkland Islands, but still actually quite a long way away. And so St Helena enter this competition and bring a team all the way over from there. And this is all that they have by way of competition. It's not like France, not like the brilliant Coupe de France, where because, you know, St Helena is a British dependency, it should be allowed in the FA Cup. No, there is nothing else. And you could say the same for Falkland Islands. There isn't really another competition for them. Then you have some slightly more unusual examples where you have Jersey and Guernsey themselves who compete in this. And obviously being Channel Islands, they not only have their Marathi competition for the Channel Islands every year, but they also now have clubs in the English Football League system. Then you have Bermuda, who are in CONCACAF. So you've got Bermuda from CONCACAF, and then you've got Gozo, like one of the islands of Malta. You've got Ynys Mon, which is Anglesey. And you used to have Gibraltar before Gibraltar joined UEFA. So it's a really interesting mix. But the thing that most of these teams have in common is that there aren't really a lot of great footballing opportunities. And what it does is give these islands a chance to compete.
Touching back on Gibraltar there, I couldn't help but notice that they are not an island. So how did they manage to actually qualify for that in the first place?
I've got to admit, you've absolutely schooled me there. Yeah, you're right. It's not. I mean, it is a fact that they are in the Ireland Games Association. I've, I'm pretty sure. I'm just checking that now because I feel like I've gone mad. But Gibraltar are in the Island Games Association. I guess at some point they managed to successfully convince them that they're an island. it's a very good point. This is what's interesting. Gibraltar were always in the Island Games. They competed in the football tournaments. And then, obviously, they got UEFA recognition. The last Island Games was, in fact, in Gibraltar, but they didn't host a football competition, which was actually because I think they said there weren't enough football pitches in Gibraltar, which I think, you know, you can testify to, Lee, that if you need, I think they need 4 or 5 football pitches to make this tournament work. So that made sense. They couldn't do it there. So what they actually did was hosted a tournament, which was just the football version of it, which they hosted in Anglesey. But yeah, you've really thrown me with this island thing.
Sorry, not my intention. I was just curious how a peninsula has made it into an island.
Yeah, because it opens the door to everyone, doesn't it? If you just allow peninsula, surely by precedent, you could allow Italy.
I made a list, by the way, of all of the islands that are taking part in this year's competition. The Faroes are on there that are members of UEFA and FIFA.
Mm. So Faroe Islands are competing at other events at the Island Games, so they won't be competing in the football.
Right. Okay.
In football terms, I guess the outliers this year would be Bermuda, in that Bermuda are members of a FIFA confederation and are still choosing to take part. Greenland obviously are in the process of trying to get into CONCACAF, and if they did, it'd be interesting to see if they remained part of the Island Games. But yeah, everyone else is not within a FIFA confederation.
Obviously, this tournament is a very big outlet for a lot of these participants. You mentioned there about the likes of the Falkland Islands and St. Helena, who don't really have anything else. I saw that this tournament has been sponsored by the bank NatWest since 1999, but that this edition that is currently taking place, or is taking place soon in Guernsey, is the last one that NatWest is going to sponsor. And I wonder, to what degree do you think that the future of this tournament might be at stake if there's no sponsor secured? Because it seems like something that wouldn't necessarily have much money from elsewhere to be pumped into it.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I know NatWest has been very much linked in with the tournament for a long time. It's another one of those sad ones. I remember, you know, we talk about a lot of these football events that have this very special sort of feel, this very special community feel, and they do a really important purpose for the competitors. And then you start to look at them from a cold, clinical, economic perspective, and you say, who would sponsor a tournament that is going to get relatively few column inches and yet brings in costs that are astronomical when you think about bringing some of these teams from these remote locations in? In terms of sponsorship, I think you do have to be concerned about a tournament like this because there's perhaps a lack of economic viability. It's not like this tournament's going to be in everyone's living rooms this summer. So you do start to wonder whether something like this could be under threat with the sponsor leaving. I do think the list of members is interesting, and there are some that are definitely more affluent and places that perhaps a local business could want to, you know, step in and cover the costs. So you look at islands like Jersey and Guernsey, a lot of very well-off businesses and business interests are located within Jersey and Guernsey. Maybe the hope is that somewhere like that, you'd find sources of money where a business will step forward. But yeah, it's a very good, very interesting what the future holds for it.
The island of Sark, I have to say, I don't really know much about it at all, but I looked on the Wikipedia page for the Island Games and I saw the following quote: Sark could be considered the most successful island, their population of 600 having acquired 20 medals by 2015, one for every 30 people. Where is Sark? And I think you had a couple of stories to share about them.
Sark is one of the Channel Islands. It's probably one of the lesser known Channel Islands. It's tiny. It's a really small island. It's just off Guernsey. I think it's technically part of Guernsey's like sphere. I think there's a name like the Balloch of Guernsey. My pronunciation is terrible. But basically, it's part of that region. What's really interesting about Sark is, for a start, it's kind of got a very old feudal feel to it. It's got a really odd system of governance. Very few things have changed like over hundreds of years. It also doesn't have cars. Cars are banned there. The only things allowed are tractors, bicycles and horse-drawn vehicles, which is really interesting. Like I remember visiting when I was really little, and it's an amazing place. Feels very much like you're stepping back in time, which is why it was really confusing when they entered the Island Games football competition back in 2003. because you wouldn't really have thought it was possible for them to have a team big enough, you know, enough people wanting to play. And it did not go well. It probably doesn't surprise you. They lost 19-0 to Gibraltar, 20-0 to the Isle of Wight, 16-0 to Greenland, and 15-0 to Frøya. And that gave them an unwanted record, which actually meant they were the first team ever to fail to score a goal in an Island Games competition. And then after that, interestingly, the team seems like the team sort of continued to exist. And I think may have even played games against Guernsey or in the Guernsey League system before eventually just, I think, has sort of sputtered out. But it gives Sark, when you look at, so obviously I've done a fair bit of this in my life, when you look at lists of teams regarded as the world's worst team, Sark are one of the teams that make that list, just simply for the fact that they had this very short spell of playing and lost incredibly heavily and then haven't really competed since. So there isn't a lot of positive to take out of it, really.
Finally, and very briefly, what is the format of this tournament and who might we expect to be the bigger hitters for this edition?
It's groups and then it goes through to a knockout. In terms of the bigger hitters, so basically your favourites for the competitions on the men's side. So it's important to remember the men's and a women's competition. On the men's side, Anglesey won it last time in Innismon. They were at home. Greenland didn't compete last time. So Greenland will definitely be amongst the strongest teams too. Greenland will take it very seriously. Greenland also know that they're effectively sort of being watched at the moment by the powers that be within the CONCACAF system. And there's a real onus on them to prove that they are serious. And so I think Greenland will take this very seriously on the men's side. And then the Isle of Man are a very strong team as well. Again, on the men's side, there's a suspicion that they might play a weakened side because they also have a club team. And it's not, I don't think people are quite certain, or people I've spoken to aren't quite certain about how much the Island Games now is something that they're seeing as their main focus. The real outsiders, as ever, will probably be St Helena, who, you know, it's incredible that they're there at all. In terms of names, you won't get a better name in the tournament than Schmeichel Benjamin, who plays for St Helena. Absolutely fantastic name. My sort of allegiance will always be with St Helena because it's just such an incredibly difficult task that they've come all these thousands and thousands of miles to this competition. Hopefully they might get a win, which would be amazing for them.
Brilliant. I feel like I've learned a real lot there. I'll keep an eye on the Island Games. I imagine that's one of those competitions that it will be pretty much impossible to watch anywhere, but certainly has piqued my interest.
I don't know. What I would do is check Facebook. I think there's a chance there might be some streams on official Facebook pages and pages like that. I think the last time the tournament was on, it was really difficult because it was in Anglesey and it wasn't the official Island Games. It was this sort of unofficial version to fill the gap. I remember watching St Helena's games on a Facebook live stream taken from the phone of one of the coaching staff of the St Helena team. So as they conceded more and more goals, it got more and more jerky and angry as the stream. So here's hoping we'll have something a bit better this time around.
That's it for part two, but before we move on, a very brief word about our Patreon. If you enjoyed this segment about football in unrecognized territories, then you're going to love our bonus episode about Paul's travels to Transnistria and Somaliland, which will be released in the week commencing 17th of July. We've also done another travel episode, which is out already, about our experiences in UEFA's two smallest member states, San Marino and Gibraltar. So if that sounds up your street, you can sign up at patreon.com/sweeperpod. We're working on introducing more benefits to the Patreon soon, so watch this space. But if you enjoy the pod and want to help it grow, please do consider supporting us. With that plug over, we'll be back in a second for our third and final segment, where we'll show some love to Europe's summer leagues. Welcome back to part three of The Sweeper, and it's time to talk about summer leagues. Of the 54 top flights in UEFA, 12 are what we in the business of niche European football term summer leagues, because they play through the summer, and that is mostly, but not always, due to the weather. The countries in question are Iceland, Ireland, the Faroe Islands, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belarus, Georgia, and Kazakhstan. And as this is the final pod before many of Europe's other leagues begin their new seasons, we wanted to dedicate this segment to the summer leagues, starting with Norway. And that is because the Eliteserien is currently topped by Bodø/Glimt in first and Tromsø in second. And that's of interest to us, of course, as lovers of football in the Arctic Circle, because those are the only two top flight clubs in Norway and indeed across all of Europe that are based in the Arctic Circle. And actually, I was doing a little bit of reading on these football times and I stumbled across an article which said that before 1972, clubs from the north were not even allowed to compete in the Eliteserien. And now you've got it sort of 50 years later, a situation where they are actually bossing the domestic scene.
That is pretty phenomenal when you think about it. From what I can see, they're pretty far away at the top in terms of like Bodø/Glimt have got a pretty decent lead. Troms have got a game in hand and, you know, still a couple of points ahead of Brann in third. So it's like, it's early days, but that history could be on the cards. I didn't actually know that was the case, that there was a rule that prevented them competing in the top flight. That seems very harsh, to be honest.
Yeah, basically just saying you're not good enough. And I think obviously the north of Norway is much more sparsely populated than the south. I think it was sort of a little bit of arrogance and looking down on them. If you look at some of the achievements that Bodø/Glimt in particular have had over the past couple of years, if they do win the league this season, it would be a third title in 4 years. They've obviously had some amazing European results. I'm thinking in particular that 6-1 against Jose Mourinho's Roma, which was just fantastic. And Tromso as well. I think I'm right in saying they were promoted not all that long ago. And they're already in second position. I really like them as well because they had that kit during the World Cup with the QR code on it, which you could scan and then find out more about the human rights situation in Qatar.
Yeah, in a way, they were world leading in their response, weren't they? And for a club of that relatively small size, it was an incredible thing that they did, I thought.
And beyond Bodø/Glimt and Tromso, in third place, you have promoted Brann, who won the Norwegian Cup this season. So it really feels like the established order is being upset in Norway. You've got Molde down in sixth at the moment and Rosenborg in 12th. So definitely one to keep an eye on. From one Nordic nation to another, what historic feat are KI Klaksvik of the Faroe Islands closing in on
a perfect season, which would be an astonishing achievement, really. But at this point, looks like it's almost theirs to lose. I think we discussed Klaksvik before. They're the real kind of, at the moment, the real powerhouse of Faroese football. And it's been almost 2 years, pretty much 2 years since they lost a match, which is a pretty astonishing record in itself. So they, this season again, got off to a lightning quick start, racked up 15 wins out of 15. And then they just last weekend were playing in the, what they call the Faroese Classic. So this is the head-to-head between the two sort of historic powerhouses of Faroese football. And it's HB Tórshavn, who are the 24-time champions, playing against KI, who have won it 20 times. So it's the real, like, this is the big showpiece event of Faroese football. And I think I'm right in saying that Klaksvik were missing some of their key players. There was a real sense that perhaps this was as far as this run was going to go. But sure enough, they came out 2-0 winners. So they have got to the break point in the Faroe Islands football. They're having a little pause now. With 16 wins out of 16, they're 12 points top. So the title is really looking very, very much like it could be in the bag. But if they do manage to complete this kind of incredible achievement of a perfect season, they'll be joining like a really small number of clubs who have ever pulled that off.
Yeah, I found actually an article on Wikipedia which had a list of the clubs that have won every game in their domestic season. So the first one was Rangers in 1898-99. They won all 18 of their matches. You also have in there Ferencváros, Dresdner SC, and that's it, I think. And they were all before or during World War II. So to the best of my knowledge, no club in a UEFA country or indeed any country worldwide has done so in men's football in that time. So this would be a huge, huge achievement. They are basically 11 games away from immortality. And people will say, well, it's only the Faroe Islands, but nobody's done it in any other country, big or small, for such a long time. You can't look past what a huge achievement it would be.
No, it'd be absolutely incredible thing to have pulled off. The only thing that I do wonder whether it will hurt them is the European campaign, whether that's going to add a little bit of a demand for them to sort of balance. So they've got quite a tough European tie. They've got Ferencváros in the Champions League first qualifying round. And you do wonder if maybe when that starts to come in, that can take a toll on a team and sort of the depth of the squad. But yeah, I've got to say I'm kind of rooting for them because I think it'd be an amazing piece of history and a great trivia fact to retain for pub quizzes.
Next up, it's time to talk about Latvia's duopoly, as any self-respecting European football podcast should. And that's because at the moment, there is a crazy two-horse title race going on in Latvia between two of the Riga clubs. So you've got Riga FC and RFS. They are both at least 18 points clear of the rest of the teams in the league. They've been so dominant with their goal differences of plus 39 and 43 respectively that their next best goal difference is plus two. Wow. So this is really just two horses in this race and no one else. But what interests me the most about this is that it's two clubs that are relatively new on the scene. So both Riga FC and RFS were promoted from the second tier in 2016. And RFS took the place of Skonto Riga, who were denied a license. And we all know Skonto Riga for being the club that holds the record for the most consecutive domestic titles in the European country, 14, which they share with the Lincoln Redims. So I just thought it's interesting that the whole landscape of Latvian football really seems to have changed in such a short space of time.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? Because as you say, growing up, it was always Skonto Riga. That was the name. I basically learned all my geography through football teams. So if you said Latvia to me, I'd say Skonto Riga. That was how I remembered it. And it's interesting that club, yeah, obviously isn't anymore on the landscape. And it is quite a unique situation, isn't it? That you kind of have this change of the guard and completely new names coming in and sort of setting up a new rivalry. The league was won by someone different last year, though, wasn't it? I have this memory of it being a team I hadn't heard of who won the Latvian league last year.
Yeah, a first-time winner, Valmiera. But again, they're another new club that hasn't won a trophy before. That was their very first trophy. And so I guess it's just another example of there are all of these new clubs sort of dominating Latvian football, and your likes of your Skonto Rigas, and also there was another one, Ventspils, who I think was a name you used to hear quite a lot about a decade ago, and they are certainly no longer in the top flight. So it just definitely feels like Latvia is like one of these young leagues where the newest clubs are the ones faring the best. Finally, in this summer league segment, let's touch back on Belarus and the three clubs sanctioned following the match fixing scandal we talked about three or four episodes ago. And the number of points we told you had been deducted were not strictly true, were they, Paul?
Oh, no, but it was worse, was it not? So Shakhtar Soligorsk, the champions, we reported to you they'd had 30 points deducted. It seems that was reviewed and they decided it had to be 35 instead. And I find there's something, you know, it's not a funny subject, but I do find it slightly comic, the idea that they thought 30 points, oh, no, we'll appeal that. All right, 35. I mean, it's a crippling points deduction. But what I find really interesting is that Shakhtar Soligorsk have actually had a really good start to the season. So they've got this points penalty that's absolutely brutal and would sink more or less any club. But they've come out swinging and battled their way back to a mere minus 6 points and would actually be competing for the title were it not for this points deduction. So it's really interesting. 9 wins, 2 draws and 2 defeats. And I think, you know, I'd recommend at Belpod for your Belarusian football needs on Twitter. I don't profess to be an expert, but it seems to me that they've kept a strong and functioning squad, but that there's a sense that may not last, because obviously the reality is starting to hit home that however well they do this season, there is a limit. You know, they're not going to be in Europe next year. They weren't allowed to be in Europe this year because of the deduction. So I feel like maybe it might be hard for them to maintain this rate, but it seems very unlikely they'll be relegated. They'll pull themselves out, I think. Whereas Energetic, the other team, have had a much more depressing start and they've actually only had 3 wins. They're still on minus 11. So they look more deflated.
Shakhtar Soligorsk are, of course, the reigning champions, although they were stripped of that title in the wake of that scandal. But you would expect a reigning champion to finish 35 points above the relegation zone, wouldn't you? So that's what I'm curious to see right now, is if they have enough to beat relegation. And I would have thought that they would. I think they're the likeliest to stay up. And then I think Belchina Brobrarisk are probably the likeliest to go down, because I think they haven't won a game, or they've only won one game since that scandal broke. So I think they're the ones that will definitely go down. An Energetic BGU remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think there was a lot of talk, and some of it was slightly angry conspiracy theory-ish talk that this would mean Dynamo Minsk were absolutely, you know, it was a cakewalk. They would win the title by a mile. But actually what's quite interesting is a team that we've already alluded to on the pod this week have emerged as slightly unlikely title contenders. And that's this team, Neman, who are currently second and only 2 points behind Dynamo Minsk. And they're only ninth last season, Neman Grodno. And it could be that they are sort of dealt this opportunity to become a bigger force in Belarusian football by this really unprecedented, really, collapse of some of the biggest teams in the nation. Just this very sudden house of cards falling down at the top might benefit them. And also possibly opens the door to one of the more established teams like Bate or Islok coming through as well. But to be totally honest, the really interesting thing to me is just seeing these teams at the bottom attempting, it's almost like a sort of challenge you might put on Football Manager or something, attempting to keep themselves up, despite the fact that they are clearly still the strongest teams in the country in many ways.
Yeah, I think we think on very similar lines, because it just came up in my head as a Football Manager or Championship Manager style challenge there. I think we'll draw a line under this episode. And today, Paul, I'm not even going to ask you for any other business because you've got bags to pack. This episode has been recorded a little bit in advance so that Paul can begin this epic journey to Micronesia. So have a safe journey and we'll catch up with you for a mammoth Micronesia pod at the end of the month. That's all from us. We'll catch you next time.